Okay, you're there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's pick up where we left off. So you were mentioning the Eskimo granny who has all this disaster, tragedy in her life, people dying, her language being wiped out and all this stuff, and relating it to me saying you couldn't have the Catholic Church anymore. You seem to be emphasizing, or thought I was emphasizing, destruction. Barry Nevitt has a book, came out in 1982, called The Communication Ecology. Now, it seems to me, I get this from what you're writing, but you don't spell it out, because you do say the world's going to hell in a handbasket. It's getting worse and worse. But isn't part of McLuhan's vision is that acoustic space is bouncing off visual, or visual's bouncing off acoustic, and there's a harmonious ecology underneath everything? You know, he says...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So, so yes, the Eskimo lady, or they call them Inuit now, I guess, she got a lot of bad scenes, but a lot of good scenes. But I'm not talking on personal experience. So this is where we get to the crux of the matter of what you're talking about by ontology and experience and what I think I'm talking about. So you have a collective consensus that's happened because McLuhan says that we had so many rapid changes in technology that we begin to see a larger pattern, which he calls the third Copernican revolution of pattern recognition. And let me bring up my notes. You have a quote there. Let's see if I can bring it up real quickly. There it is. We live in the first age when change occurs sufficiently rapidly to make such pattern recognition possible for society at large. So we grope toward, it says before that, we grope toward a consciousness of the unconscious, toward a realization that technology is an extension of our own bodies. So if we have a collective consensus or people seeing changes and coming to a kind of agreed concept about what the percept is, which could never happen in such a huge scale, isn't that what McLuhan's saying, that we need a new language, if we've got to use words, to explain that we've arrived at a kind of technological Esperanto, collective ESP, where we could agree, through computers, okay, let's turn off the internet for 6 weeks and assess what it's been doing to us or what it's like to have a media fast. Now, I'm not saying that could be done, but extending from what he said to Playboy in March 69, that you can modulate the media, isn't that a new situation that the experience that the Eskimo has or we have personally, it's not the level McLuhan's talking about. He's talking about a collective language, an impersonal language. Technically, he's talking technically.
Mm-hmm.
How do you answer that?
I think it's right. I think that what's necessary there, just as I was saying frequently when we were talking before, is that the different terms there need to be made precise in order for us to understand what's going on. So, for example, when he says that there's this new collective consciousness, that's not a consciousness that everybody knows that it's there, and it's certainly not a consciousness that the individual even recognizes in him or herself. It is something that gives a new possibility for communication, but it still has to face all of the old problems of communication that communication ever had to face.
Right, so that the part of the ecology is that we mythically or perceptually live in the 20th century, he used to say, but we think in terms of the 19th century. So all the various aberrated specialist business that goes on, including universities teaching 19th century topics or categories, makes wealth, McLuhan would say. So we have an incredibly wealthy society with a lot of what he even says garbage apocalypse, but that bounces off the silence we've arrived at, that nobody knows how to communicate on a broad scale, so we replay all the old media, you can say the analog media, and if you think making wealth is a productive situation, then we're making a lot of wealth with stupidity, with human stupidity. It's like McLuhan saying, we got managers galore for the global theater. So has McLuhan come to the correct poetic language to unite the world? You're saying people don't know what he's pointing out, but if more people heard it, would they agree, or would human stupidity just carry on going, and he defined original sin as a kind of denial, would continue with their head in the sand and deny the Esperanto that's happened. Is that possible?
Sure, it's possible, but that's the question.
Yeah.
Right? And it's an outstanding question. I mean, when he died, I don't think there were many people that understood him.
They didn't know that question. What we just defined, they didn't know that's the question he was posing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He used to say, we have the 20th century man runs down the street, you know, I've got all the answers, but what are the questions? And he actually said blatantly, I have the questions.
Right.
You know, he declared that he'd broken through into the silent sea and could talk about it. So you're recognizing that. You see that.
Well, I guess so, but when you say that may cover a wealth of sins here.
No, but let's go back to what you just said. You said that is the question, that he has come up with the new science, the new language that one would teach. You would teach his books. You would teach his terms. And with your proviso put in there, which is important, I think that's the word proviso or qualification.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, you know, there's the gap and we have finitude and we don't really know what we're talking about, but that's okay because that's part of growing.
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, when somebody makes a proposal at this level, as I think McLuhan did, that's not something that happens that comes to fruition in a lifetime, and maybe not in a generation. These are problems that have always been around. McLuhan saw new possibilities for addressing them, and what success he may have is something that depends on the future.
Yeah,
it depends on people like you and me who actually think about what he was saying and try to relay it in a way that somehow communicates.
Right. So I'm saying then that what you're talking about, and I said this a few years ago, I think I said it on Montgomery's list. Remember back 2002 or something, you'd be on the list and you'd come in with your times, the complicated concept. You remember how you used to write your
sure.
post?
Yeah, sure.
And I used to say, well, that's conceptualizing something that you can't type to express. Now, now that I reread, well, you've done a lot of work the last few years, so we didn't know you would do what you've done 10 years ago.
Yeah, sure.
Now you produce a really good work, and it clarifies a lot of things about what you were meaning 10, 12 years ago. But I come back to the point that there's something hyperverbal about it, and maybe you know that because you're saying, I got to use words to talk to you. What is the value of knowing, since McLuhan said that no philosophical genius king could solve this issue, he implied we have to get to air traffic controlling with the media environment, so there has to be some kind of consensus by an elite, like some elite cabal in the CIA or something, that says, okay, we're going to do this. And then if you actually tried, I've presented these ideas, the Venezuelan modulation idea, to professors, and they go, well, that's fascism. You can't take over the system and modulate TV in that. So they couldn't see, they still had the humanist principles of individual freedom and access to own individual autonomy and all that. They couldn't see how dire the situation was, and you would need to bring in a collective solution like that, which you're saying the economists are trying to re-express this in Davos, you know. Hey, we got to figure out how to manage this thing. It's not working for anybody. So if we've come to that point now where we could see what McLuhan's questions are, what is the relevance of pointing out an incomplete understanding of McLuhan's art, which are his books? His books are an art, and they express the ongoing eternal communication problem. Do you see that we've broken into a new situation where your issues may not apply? And understanding of McLuhan does not apply if an elite took over? The elite implemented it?
Well, I just disagree with your reading of what he meant by ivory tower to control tower.
Right.
And how this would work. I believe that the consensus that he was talking about, the common language, is something that Gideon was talking about a lot in the 1940s, and that McLuhan, I think, kind of picked it up from him.
Yes.
Where Gideon was always saying that we need what he called a faculty of interrelations. And a faculty of interrelations, I'm just writing a post on it now, actually, he envisioned as a mega department or faculty at a university where there would be scientists and humanists and engineers and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But Gideon was well aware that that faculty, which would try to evolve a common language, depended upon faculties of interrelations which already exist, for example, amongst the senses and in an operating society. There are already faculties of interrelation going on. So what I see McLuhan trying to do with people like Gideon is to try to take the existing situation of humans and show that it has possibilities which have not yet been realized. So this is a situation that has existed ever since there were humans. People have seen new possibilities to round objects or to hard objects or to soft objects or to certain kinds of food or whatever. So McLuhan says now with mass media, we have new opportunities for communication, not in the sense of communicating like the mass media, but really communicating, that we may be able to use to solve problems that people have been trying to address since Plato and before. So his consensus, if you will, is not some sort of fascist group of 20 that says, here's the new language. It's a language that people learn to speak exactly like people learn to speak chemistry instead of alchemy.
Right.
Alchemy was inherently fascist because its findings depended upon some person and some group insisting that that was the way to look at matter.
Right.
But the chemists came along and they said, no, let's not look at matter in a forcible way. Let's find out what matter is saying to us. Let's probe it, and we'll communicate through successful prediction.
Right.
And I think that's what McLuhan wants to do.
Right.
But at the same time, McLuhan says, look, the problem here is that the possibility that I'm trying to point to is already being used in a semi-conscious way,
yeah,
in advertising, in propaganda, in entertainment, in a way that leads to the enslavement of mind unless mind can find out what's actually going on there.
All right. Did you know that James Joyce's last colleague was Siegfried Gideon?
Well, Gideon's wife, Carola, was the person that arranged for Joyce and his family to come from occupied France to Zurich.
Yes.
And then he died in January 41.
Yeah.
And Carola Gideon Welker was the person that persuaded Nora, Joyce's wife, to get a death mask made of Joyce. And she had it made, and then she wanted to give it to Nora. Nora didn't want it, so the Gideons ended up with it.
Right. Now, the point I'm bringing up is that Joyce and Gideon discussed the deeper levels of Finning's Wake, like how it could be broadcast, or how it could be done in different media. And so Gideon puts out Space, Time, and Architecture in 39, the same year as Finning's Wake. It's like they were both working on the same problems, you know, differently. But you saying that he was proposing a faculty of interrelations might have gotten that idea in his talks with Joyce, because they were it was basically Gideon was the only guy Joyce could talk to in the final years that understood the new issues. So I'm just wondering if you were aware of how intimate their conversation was, and it might have influenced Gideon's work.
Maybe. I mean, Gideon was a pretty fascinating guy. He and his wife had relationships with all kinds of artists and
yes.
Architects and museum people all over the world.
Yeah.
And in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, they were working very, very hard to try to bring the language and insight of new art to the world.
Yes.
So a lot of their friends were Joyce's friends.
Yeah.
Especially in Paris, but not only in Paris. So the I don't think that the model works if we say, well, their communication was person to person. In fact, there were groups that were in sometimes close, sometimes distant communication with each other, and these ideas were kind of in the air, and McLuhan was one of the people that picked up on these ideas.
Yeah.
But he was certainly not the only one, and Gideon, as you say, was at least in the 30s and 40s, was probably closer to the center of this network than McLuhan.
Yeah, oh yeah, no, I agree with that. And it's interesting how Marshall's work, in a way you could look at him as a propagandist for the network of Joyce and Gideon and whoever else was part of their inside communication. You know, he picked up that circle. And when Explorations came out, the second issue where Don Thiel, the young, you know, potential PhD student, if this is in 54, he's just he's going to get his PhD in 50 later, 54. So he's you know, one of the brightest students in McLuhan, and he writes a really good article on Finnegan's Wake for Explorations, and Carol Gideon Welker writes and says, this is the best thing I've ever written on Joyce's book. I mean, I've ever read. She says, the best thing I've ever read. So she really complimented Don and indirectly McLuhan. She was up on the Exploration Group, and then Gideon, he's on the staff as a writer for it eventually. So it's interesting how McLuhan picked up that European circle. And then I guess a few other people like Maholi Naj, who is also from the Bauhaus or the European circle too. So
well, they were, Gideon and Maholi were intimate friends.
Yeah. You can see that.
From Europe.
Right. So if someone knew what those people were doing in Europe, and we can know it now, but back then, they say, holy shit, this McLuhan guy is a PR propagandist for those guys, for Maholi Naj and Gideon. Do you know what I mean? Because he's celebrating their work. Don Thiel will say that Maholi Naj's books are more important than Innes, as far as McLuhan was concerned, what he learned from it, just like Gideon's books were. So it's I'm just pointing out that McLuhan inherited an ongoing dialogue.
Yeah, that's
on.
True. Absolutely. Yeah. McLuhan, there's very little that is invented in McLuhan. there's lots of stuff that he discovers.
Yes.
Right? So it's sitting there. And McLuhan is simply interesting in that he brings this, he puts together the focus on communication, which was already there, and the focus on the senses, which was already there, partly in the Catholic Church and partly in the New Artist. And he brings those together to try to show that there's ways of talking about communication and the senses and the media which sort of structurally overlap and which can be used.
Yeah, it just occurred to me, you know how the great poets say they come out of their time and they communicate some kind of new relation between humans and nature or humans and the new technology. I'm just thinking now that there was a network, almost like a meme growing in Europe and maybe parts of the United States and other parts around the world, of this network of people that Gideons were the center of. McLuhan becomes the poet of that network, of that meme, not the urban landscape like Baudelaire, not the Moore's landscape, the romantic landscapes of out in the wilderness, not whatever Shakespeare was doing the landscape of. He picked up the core. It's almost like the better grouping, better than the Macy conferences, which were going on in the 40s, right? So you have the Macy, who's the poet of the Macy conferences? And is McLuhan a poet of a more perceptive group? Anyways, it just struck me that a new kind of poetry, a poetry of a meme, the best meme that was circulating, represented by Joyce and Gideon and other people, Wyndham Lewis.
But notice that he kind of gave up on that, right? He was intensely involved with this sort of stuff in the 40s and up until maybe 1955.
Yeah, when he got disappointed with the results of the exploration seminar.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. So because the exploration seminar was a kind of faculty of interrelations,
yeah,
like Gideon had been pushing. So then he, funnily enough, he then goes back to 1940, which is when he was at St. Louis University with Muller team.
Yeah.
And at the time, Muller team had, I forget, I think he had 6 children by then. Eventually he had 8. So trying to exist as a faculty member at a Catholic university with 6 kids, I mean, it was impossible.
Yeah.
So he was working on the side for a business in St. Louis, where he was functioning more or less as a consultant. And then after the war, he actually became a consultant. And so through him, McLuhan started to read Drucker. And through these guys, he began to see parallels between what was going on in the arts and what was going on in business.
Yes.
So then I think what happened is in the late 50s, partly because Muller team began to publish again himself then, Muller team had published in the late 40s a lot of business stuff, and then he was mostly silent in the 50s, but in around 1960, he started to publish again, and especially he published an article that McLuhan quotes at length in Gutenberg Galaxy. So McLuhan starts at the end of the 50s and the early 60s to think that the way to communicate this stuff is to follow up on how it's already being used in business.
Yeah.
So you say to business people, look, here's what you are already doing.
Yeah, you're in the information business. You're not in the light bulb business. You're in the information business.
Right. So, and partly, again, this may partly have to do with how his brain was working.
Yeah.
Right? It's not to try to deal with the cantos, let's say. It takes a huge amount of mental energy to deal with an essay in a public relations review or something, you can do when you're doing 11 other things.
Yes.
It doesn't require any energy at all. And so there may be a conservation of energy principle at work here, as well as a communications efficiency angle.
You're saying that McLuhan dropped studying cantos and then worked with the business world because he had less energy to do the poetry analysis?
I'm just saying it's something to think about.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I know that that's the case.
Right.
I do know that his McLuhan's later articles on Eliot and Pound are not anywhere near as exciting as his early stuff.
Yeah, he's actually just using those articles to put his stuff, those reviews in Renaissance, or he's just putting his stuff in there, not even discussing the details like a traditional critic.
Mm-hmm. But even the stuff in Renaissance is still fairly early, right? He stopped doing anything in Renaissance by the end of the 60s, right?
No, 62. Yeah. He stopped in 62.
Yeah. Okay, so that's... there's nothing in Renaissance except maybe the very latest essays that reflect any kind of lethargy.
You mean in 62, essays in 61, 62 reflect that lethargy?
Well, I mean, first off, I'm just talking through my hat here, right? we're just speaking hypothetically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because I don't really have an opinion on... how badly was McLuhan's brain affected in 1960, and how can we see this in changes between the 50s and the 60s, or the 40s and the 60s, or the 40s and the 70s? I haven't done that work, and so I'm not trying to pronounce anything here as if I had done the work.
Right.
We're just sort of talking out loud. But it's certainly the case that McLuhan's focus changed, and the points that he was trying to emphasize greatly changed. He had been intensely interested on technical questions in aesthetics, and that after 1960 or so, that's gone.
Yeah,
it just never appears again. And after 1960, he's highly interested in management questions, how business works, how business communicates, all those sorts of stuff. There's a little of that earlier, but not much.
Right. Now, Peter Montgomery was a student of him of McLuhan in 62 or so, and he says he noticed that McLuhan dropped the whole effort represented by his critical reviews in Renaissance, that he's a witness, he says, to the shift that happened in McLuhan that you're referring to, which happened from 62 on. Now, maybe he shifted being a very perceptive person because the satellite demanded a whole bigger operation, a bigger platform, and he moved to, he changed, like he said, Wyndham Lewis was always changing to the new environments, responding to him. So McLuhan dropped the puny stuff of writing reviews for books because he could see the impact of the satellite and meant a whole new level, maybe the extension of consciousness itself, he proposed. And it's not that he was tired or brain damaged, is that he responded to the new environment.
Maybe.
What makes you balk at that? What does your idea of the eternal agon of communication struggle not fit that point?
Well, it's just the point I was making before, Bob, about you walking out and talking to people on the street. I don't know that they're existing in different environments, but I do know that they have completely different perspectives, experience, hopes, dreams, etc. So
individually, you mean individually they do.
Right.
But that's the user's the content, and that's not relevant to the management of the collective ESP, the techno-simulated environments that are swamping everybody. He didn't take an interest in what – he wouldn't go out in the street and be thrown by all the variety of opinions. He would notice something common to them all. They all are talking excitedly because they have radio and TV going on all the time in their homes, and they aren't talking like their great-grandparents.
Yeah,
yes, go ahead.
The point I'm trying to make is that in order to talk well about environments, it's necessary to be able to specify them. And if you go out and you talk to people on the street and they disagree a lot, then that's just a sign that whatever we mean by environment isn't just sort of being out there in the air. It doesn't mean being alive at the same time that we have television or computers or something. It means if it has meaning, then there's something more specific going on. And I think what you're saying is that in order to get at the specificity of environments, you need to bring an artistic temperament to that question. And then you go from there to saying, and McLuhan was a very good artist of these environments, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I can see. I mean, that's my bent is to say that he was tending more or less well, more or less consciously to science, not science in the way that it was developed by Eric and Laws of Media, but nonetheless real science. And your tendency is much more to say that his tendency was artistic and I don't know.
Aesthetic. No, I can answer this. When I spoke at the Legacy of McLuhan Forum, I said that McLuhan was only a Manipian satirist in his books and maybe interviews while he waited to take over the United Nations with his elite to manage the global thermostat, and that the Manipian satire is a minor activity. It's just what he did in books. It's how it was a tradition that he was familiar with. So he communicated his, I got to use words with you, level, Gutenberg analog media, as a side operation while waiting for the world to catch up to him, and then he could take over the White House or something, or take over, you know, some kind of a managed situation they're trying to imagine in the Davos conference now. So I recognize the science part, what they tried to do in that 1964 press conference when Understanding Media came out in May 64. I'm including that part, but that's put on hold because nobody's responding to it. They don't know that he means that. And so then I can talk about Finnegan's Wake. I used to tell this to Don Thiel. Don, you come at this like a university president, which you were, and you're trying to preserve the curriculum for education. That's very puny to the level that McLuhan was operating on.
Sure. I completely agree with that.
Good.
But the I think you use words like take over in ways that I think you yourself may not have thought about very carefully, because let's just think about when around 1810, let's say,
yeah.
when people are beginning to get an idea about chemical elements. If you think about what happened between, let's say 1816 and 2016, 200 years of the growth of science, but not just the growth of science, the growth of scientific institutes, periodicals, cyclotrons, telescopes in Hawaii, you know, on and on and on, taking over actually happened, but it happened on a vast scale.
Yes.
But this is something that can't even remotely be compared to, say, the 30 tyrants taking over Athens. This is something
no.
that, if this has to do with technology, with the whole organization of life, the whole organization of the planet. And it's something that the planet may not even survive. But so when McLuhan is talking about a new way of thinking taking over, and of that way of thinking being comparable to a thermostat, this kind of takeover is what the chemical element has done, but it's the thermostat is all of these universities, all of these cyclotrons, all of these telescopes, all of these scientific journals, on and on and on and on. That kind of takeover is an absolutely massive, world-changing happenstance.
But I think McLuhan saw that happening.
I think a couple
of quotes.
We agree on that, Bob.
Yeah, so I call it tetrad management, and that just like there's this pumping group that supposedly keeps Wall Street going. You know, you've heard about them. This the pump up the volume kind of guys. They just send money in or credits, whatever it is, so a crash can't become a final crash. Have you heard of that kind of talk?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So, and we see it in daily science fiction. It began with the James Bond movies. So this is what was interesting, that McLuhan saw that. He said it's a CIA world, it's a James Bond world. He saw that elites around Kissinger, he called Kissinger the kiss of death. He called him the trigger man. And he actually, that very interesting statement he makes in 1951 to Pound, that he's going to create something on the sidelines to distract the trigger men. That would be the Dulles brothers at that point in the 50s for Eisenhower. And then you, he said, and I would needle the somnambulist. That would be the average citizen. So he had several prongs going on. He was always ready to talk to intelligence people if they showed up and were interested. Now, I found out later in the late 80s that the Pentagon was using the tetrad. They called it sociological algorithms. And it was what, when the wall went down, and I think Bush and Gorbachev met in Malta in December 89, Gorbachev said, give me your sociological algorithms. I got to manage the dismantling of my former empire, the Soviet Union, and the tetrad is provides the pattern. So they were using it. It's like McLuhan was aware of. Now, have you seen Richard Barbrook's book, Imaginary Futures, where he goes back to the 50s and shows how the KGB was using McLuhan and then CIA and then the guy who took over from Kissinger, the Polish guy, you know, National
Security. Yeah, Brzezinski.
Yeah, Brzezinski, his book. They were trying to talk on the level, or were talking on the level that McLuhan was presenting himself by 1961, 62, saying the satellite's an art form. We've got to look at these media environments like air traffic control. He had moved. He was as a real artist, a poet of his time, he was reflecting what was going on in science and technology, as he said, most art had done for 300 years. It took the latest developments and made art from it, or provided a mirror. So this massive technological brain trust, which is the way Finnegan's Wake ends, with a brain trust, and they finally get through, figure out who Finnegan is. You know, that's how it ends. And he has the word brain trust. So he's aware of what Roosevelt's doing, the secret cabinet's behind them. And so when McLuhan says the president of the White House is an automated presidential surrogate, that means he's not the real president. Is it superlative? Nobody. He knows that the management is happening somewhere else. And he's trying to show that, and you go back to what he says in Mechanical Bride, it's a new kind of novel. It's a science fiction novel. He's aware of science fact and science fiction in his work. And that's why he's not worried about being not 100% accurate in science fact, and he'll incorporate science fiction and mix the two and then claim that Finnegan's Wake was ahead of everybody in the world of science fiction. I see him as miming being a technocrat, but the poet of the technocrats who's saying, I know how to do it better. I see the environments that you don't see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you agree with what I'm saying there?
I let's say I agree / disagree.
Yeah, well, that's implied. If you read your stuff, that's always implied.
Let me, the way up is the way down. That's
yes.
For sure. But let's say that where we seem to disagree on the stuff you're saying there is if we look at span leading from around 1800, when the chemical element is just being considered by people like Lavoisier and Priestley, and then come up to today, I situate McLuhan's real contribution as being very close to 1800. And
the beginning, you mean the beginning?
Yeah. And
yes.
Note that in there, a lot of things become possible on the basis of what Priestley and Lavoisier did. Amongst the things that became possible were organic chemistry, biology. It leads on to genetics and to DNA code and all that sort of stuff. But in 1800 or in 1810, when this stuff was first being born, it's not as if DNA wasn't there. DNA didn't have to be invented. It just had to be discovered.
Yes.
There's a big difference.
Yeah.
So when I hear you talking about how people were managing things and how they're managing today, of course this is going on. But McLuhan didn't have the resources to specify how, and not only McLuhan didn't, nobody had or has today the specifics on how to articulate what's going on there. So McLuhan made suggestions about how we could arrive at this kind of specification. And that's where I see his contributions. I don't see that he was in 1810 doing DNA code, which is what I hear you saying sometimes.
You hear me saying that he was doing DNA code in 1810.
Yeah, when you're talking about tetrad management,
yes,
Khrushchev wanted and all this stuff. I'm not denying that the CIA and Khrushchev and Bilderberg and all this stuff, I'm not saying that they don't have ways to manipulate. Of course they do. But I don't think that they really know what they're doing, right? I mean, when in 1810, everybody was going around breathing. but they didn't know what oxygen was. They didn't know what it meant to what was going on in the lungs to process the oxygen, right? So there's a huge difference between being able to do something, even knowing that you're doing it, and knowing what you're actually doing. There's that. Unless we pay attention to those differences, it's very hard to specify where McLuhan's contribution was made.
Well, that leaves room then, since we don't know, for my projecting him further up to 1900 rather than 1810. You catch these occasional statements by him where he is speaking on the level of tetrad management. It says here and there, like, everybody says, well, you know, it wasn't the global village in McLuhan's days. He was talking about the global theater. Well, in the 70s, he changed it to global membrane. Now, that's really important. We were starting to become a little node, and we were living in the node. So you don't hear people talking about the global membrane. You might hear about the global theater at this late date. But I think that I should maybe go and try to find some of these statements like you're doing, where I see he's not in 1810, but he's like 1910. You know what I mean? I should maybe prove my case.
I find that very interesting.
Yeah.
Because to me, my whole bent is to bring the demand for specifics to any statement or any claim or anything that I myself write.
Right.
And I'm delighted. It gives me great pleasure to find out that in some place I have failed. If you were able to find that where I'm trying to situate McLuhan is actually wrong, no one would be happier than me. I would like that.
Because you're interested in the half-truth. Not the whole truth. You want the half-truth. That's enough for you. So this thing about agreeing and disagreeing, I've actually used that. I spoke once, and I laid out the formal dynamic, the medium, and not the content so much. And so somebody in the audience says, wait a minute, what about advertising and all the content manipulation? And I said, well, I meant that, but my mouth can only say univocally one sentence at a time. I can't say the other opposite sentences at the same time. You know what I mean? So I actually came up with this excuse that I included what I didn't say, which would be I disagree with what you're hearing me say right now, which is what you point out, the agree-disagree. He said there's an article in Rolling Stone just after he dies, some of those guys that knew him out in San Francisco, you know, around Gossage, and one of the guys says he recalls that McLuhan said something, and the guy disagreed, and McLuhan said, yeah, I meant that, but I left that out. In other words, what I just told you I did, I got it from McLuhan. He said that. He says, yes, I meant that when I didn't say it. This guy tells the story of that. So when you're looking at McLuhan and you're watching a face talk to you, that face has got more than a univocal response to you.
Of course, that we're getting back to L.T. McLuhan and being an impersonator. that's what the unconscious is for McLuhan, is all of these different voices, all of these different possibilities, and what the human individual is constantly doing is going down into these voices like Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
And the part of of individual life, and especially of collective life, that we see going on around us is just the tip of the iceberg, that where things get screwed up because we know so little about what's essentially going on.
No, but well said. I agree with that. It's interesting.
By the way, let me just interrupt for a second before I forget about this. But remember, I was talking about a letter where McLuhan talks about having to learn the way a child learns?
Yes.
It was a letter to John Snyder. It's actually quite a long letter. He wrote two long letters to John Snyder in the summer of 63. And he says here, we are already moving in depth. And when McLuhan says in depth, we have to hear not only that he's treating a question deeply, but we also have to hear that he's speaking synchronically.
Yes.
He's speaking about seeing something that's going on in depth at the moment as we speak.
Yes.
So he says, we are already moving in depth into a situation in which learning becomes a total process from infancy to old age. The pattern by which one learns one's mother tongue is now being extended to all learning whatsoever. Right now, so if we think about the child, we don't know when the child's learning of language begins, maybe already in the womb, right? But at some point, the child's hearing goes from being some kind of fantasy, some kind of interpretation that is locked into the child, and it picks up on an objectivity.
Yes.
It picks up on something that is, instead of him or her trying to inform, that is to say, bring form to what it is perceiving, it clicks onto the idea that he or she can be informed from without. It can be something that makes the child happy, who knows? But at some point, the child goes from being subjectively informed to being objectively informed. And that jump is the learning of language.
Right, and this is what the final words of Finney's Wake, the given. You've pointed that out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the given.
Absolutely.
And, another point. When McLuhan says we're all at the emotional level of a 3 or 4-year-old now, that's another way of saying that we're children now again, groping.
And yes, but he didn't mean that only positively.
Yes.
I'm sure there is some positive there, but if we think about the Eskimo grandmother for a minute, that Eskimo grandmother, with her distance from media, her distance from a city, her distance from commotion, and just dealing quietly with her tragedies and her small triumphs, has learned an equanimity that is native to the human species. It's something that our forefathers and foremothers learned over hundreds of thousands of years, and we've basically thrown it away in the last 150. We've become this kind of emotional maturity that you find in old people in a primitive setting is something that is native to humans and essentially humans. And yet in our stupidity, we've shit-canned it.
Yeah. Yeah, the horrible situation in senior homes now.
Oh, sure. And then if you compare the grandmother who's cold, she doesn't have the right clothes, she doesn't have the right food and all this stuff, sitting in a tent somewhere up in northern Canada, and then compare that to somebody in an old age home in Phoenix playing bingo from right morning until night. I mean, there you have it. I mean,
yep.
It's pathetic.
Well, that's the planet of the dead that Marshall started talking about in the 70s. So it's good the way you say, when McLuhan says we're interested in the services and disservices of the environments, you're saying, yes, services/disservices are perceived at the same time. Which is
absolutely.
Like, yeah, which is like he says, the tetrad happens all at once. That's another expression of what depth awareness, synchronicity. Mm-hmm. What is it? Synchronous. Not synchronicity, it's...
synchronicity is the noun.
Right, and right? Synchronous.
Synchronous, that's the adjective.
Oh, okay. Right, and the diachronic. So, let's see. So you're bemoaning. You sound like, are you a Catholic?
No, but I often go to Mass. My wife's a Catholic. I enjoy going to the Orthodox liturgy a lot and often do go.
Right. It sounds like you're bemoaning what's happened to humanity, which McLuhan was not going to go that way completely when he was saying in Understanding Media, those that see this horrible 1984 mechanism takeover, they're not seeing the organic nature of electricity, and it's going to be totally different. And he's the closest to predicting the ecstasy of communication that Baudrillard talks about that has come about, you know, Web 2.0 and everybody being able to be their own TV news broadcasters. He was the closest to that, full potential of expressiveness. Now, the older institutions say, no, this is bad. This is, people are stupid. We don't like Wikipedia. And they're trying to get back to some slower reading, the basics, back to the basics. That's what I detect a bit in you, is that you're nostalgic for when humans were humans and really good at it.
No, here I think I'm quite close to McLuhan. It's important to see all the different sides.
Yes. So you don't mean just, you're despondent. You say this in your blog a little. Every now and then you go, we're fucked. We're not even going to survive. In case a little panic surfaces. And then you go back to your equanimity and poise and understanding, blowing both horns of your dilemma, equally satisfied. Do you see what I'm saying? And this panic or despondency shows up slightly, which you're doing a bit now. What do you say?
No, but Bob, either things are ultimately all right or they are not.
No, they're both. Using your principles, we've reached the planet of the day, but we also have the planet of rebirth.
How can I put this? When you say they're both, of course I agree with that. But what that means is that the strongest affirmation can be made of how things are in the face of the strongest denigration.
Yeah.
Right? So what I try to do in my blog is I don't say, now I'm panicked and it's the end of everything. I try to say, if we're going to take seriously that there is some sort of ground, we have to bring against that the strongest possible scenarios of disaster, because if a ground disappears the second the civilization disappears, then there is no ground.
Yeah.
Right? And so we need to be prepared for things that would be horrific.
I agree. Okay. So I'm having these ongoing conversations with Derek, and he is proposing to the Vatican a new Jesuit program. He thought the Jesuits were pretty good with the printing press, 300-400 years ago, and we needed...